We want to welcome today our pastor in residence, Pastor Stuart Schultz. He went through the synodical system studying at Austin and at Concordia Senior College in Fort Wayne. In 1972-73, he was at Westfield House in Cambridge, England. And from 1973 to 1977, he did his Master of Divinity degree here at Concordia Seminary. In 1977 to 78, he studied at Princeton and earned a THM in New Testament. His advisor was Bruce Metzger. In 1991, he earned an MA degree in classics at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He has served parishes in New Jersey, Missouri, Colorado, and is currently the senior pastor at Faith Lutheran in Columbus, Indiana. We welcome our pastor in residence, Pastor Stuart Schultz.
Thank you for welcoming me here and having me here the last couple of days. I'll be leaving early this afternoon. I want to begin by expressing my encouragement at what I find at Concordia Seminary. I had mentioned this to some of the students in devotions last night and in some of the fireside chat and some other personal conversations. I was a student here. In fact, I arrived here just in time in the fall of 1973 to see us go through those crazy and wild days of the walkout. And I do not believe that if we had been told in 1974 that the seminary would be in as healthy a condition as it is today, with faculty and staff and students and support staff in place at the level that they are, I truly believe not one of us would have believed it. Those were some wild and crazy days. Those were some dark days for the church. And there was a point, I think, when nobody suspected that Concordia Seminary, A, would survive, at least some of us had those doubts, and everybody doubted, at least in the church at large, that it would survive well. So I commend first you students who are here giving that affirmation of Concordia Seminary, and the faculty and the staff as well. Those in the church who are seeing where Concordia Seminary is are encouraged. We see the graduates coming out, and we're encouraged by those folks, the vicars as well. What you are doing well. And if I could tie into my message at the chapel yesterday, it does seem that the folks at Concordia Seminary are indeed filling the positions they occupy. And what a comfort and what an encouragement that is for us out in the congregations. For some of you who may have remembered him or still do remember him, greetings also from David Faulkner. David is our assistant pastor at Faith Lutheran in Columbus since earlier this summer. Doing a fine job, and he and Julie are going to just really be some tremendous couple for the ministry, not only immediately but down the line as well. When I was asked to make a presentation in line with my pastor and resident sort of status here for the current 3 days, I thought of a number of different ways I might go, and in the process, since last, I think it was November or so, when Dean Smith contacted me first, what I did more than anything else was to list out some sorts of emphases, maybe some sorts of insights that I have learned in parish ministry that have come as very much surprises to me. And when I thought I wanted to bring this more into focus and maybe collapse some of these categories, I tried, I wasn't successful. And more recently, when Dean Smith said, I need to kind of have a topic for this presentation, I simply looked at what I had done, and I suggested, why not a number of reasons, maybe 15 reasons, 15 things that have surprised me in the parish ministry in 18 years. And so I want to do that. I'm going to be all over the landscape, If I can use the parable of the sower again, as I did yesterday, perhaps some of the seed will fall on hard ground, some thorns, some on the rocks. But let's hope that some of these are points that you will resonate with and perhaps will take with you as a memory or a thought into the ministry. First, I mentioned in a couple of my classes how much I have been surprised at how thoroughly the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist, influences, has framed, and has directed my ministry. Let me explain a couple of the reasons of how I have found this to be true. We are at a day when there are almost unreal expectations about professional people. You and I compete, particularly now because of colored television, in a society that expects us to be the perfect preacher, the excellent administrator, the jack-of-all-answers counselor. The expectations of ministry are exceptionally high today. That causes immense frustration for congregations and for ministers and for entering clergy as well. I did not know when I came out how high those expectations were. There are some mitigating things that happen as well, and I'll get through those in a minute. But the expectations of professionals today really are daunting. So let me just leave that one hanging for a little bit. If I found another item that has, in a sense, challenged my ministry, it is to be aware how difficult it has been to initiate and then to foster community in such a hyper-individualistic society as we have today. You read the writings of Christopher Lash, you read Bella's book, Habits of the Heart, to get a feel for where we are in the 1990s. The strident emphasis on the individual, and how frustrating and how challenging it is to get a sense within a congregation that somehow there's ecclesia, that people are being pulled out of their professions at least once or twice a week, and somehow or another they're brought back into community. And to encourage people and to hope that people will find not only that they are individual brothers and sisters in Christ, but that as brothers and sisters in Christ, they're also somehow part of God's family, and that that has consequences. Very, very much of a struggle, very much of a challenge in what I call a hyper-individualistic age. I'm sure that's one of the reasons that such things as small group ministry are so well received if they are done well in congregations. But I think I was not aware of that when I entered the ministry 18 years ago, that I was going to be so challenged by the individualism that people bring to Christianity, and how challenging it is to bring to the parish ministry a sense of community, and to bring those people around the banquet on Sunday mornings, to bring them around the word, and then to foster an understanding that, yes, they are part of a family. I did not understand how challenging that would be. Number two, I did not realize 18 years ago how challenging it was going to be to preach well as often as we are asked to do in parish ministry. Any of us, yourself included, certainly have an idea, maybe three ideas, maybe half a dozen ideas, of church, of sermons that you're going to want to preach in some church someday. So do I. And those kinds of sermons are going to serve you well for special circumstances. They may even get you out of a tight spot sometime. But I don't know that I had a clear idea how challenging it is to preach at least once every Sunday morning, 50, 48 times a year. There's Advent, there's Lent, there are wedding sermons, there are funeral sermons, maybe there are some anniversary sorts of things that you're asked to do. So you're preaching 55, 60, 65, 70, 75 times a year. And you're doing that year after year after year. And the challenge to put God's old truths in new dress, I had no idea how challenging that was going to be. I don't know how to work with that except the ways I have for myself, at least. You'll have other reasons and other ways of going about it. It does seem to me that those pastors who do well in the long challenge of routine preaching are those who tend to work with the languages. It keeps you honest. It keeps you on track. It keeps you textual. I have found in those days, in those weeks, in those months when things get very, very busy, and when I don't do my language work and I don't do my commentary work, the first place that shows up is in my preaching, and my people know it and recognize it. They're very patient about it, but it's very clear that I'm not rising to the occasion quite as much as I should for the 275 people in my congregation on a Sunday morning. I have found it necessary and helpful to borrow shamelessly. I think there's something true about a saying I heard some time ago: all scholarship is plagiarism, stupidity alone is original. And I stole that. But we could do a lot worse than reading through two or three commentaries in preparation for a sermon, couldn't we? The Concordia pulpit helps now. What a fine resource. And now as we're blending those together with creative worship, we didn't have that kind of combination when I started the ministry. It's not going to solve all our questions and not going to solve all our challenges in preaching and crafting worship, but at least it's a start. I find myself in the last couple of years believing for myself that preaching that is done for the most part memorized with continuing eye contact with the congregation seems to connect better and communicate better than a read text. That's where I am. And I'm finding that A, to be very helpful, but B, yet another challenge for me as I preach, because that means that I need to push my preparation up a day or two and to be more prepared so that I have the mental flow of the sermon in my mind before I get there on Sunday morning. I don't know how it is, but one has to find one's own way of finding that hook, that one hook for a sermon around which you can develop a Christ-centered, biblically based, encouraging, gospel-centered sermon. When I can find that hook, I'm on my way. About 25 years ago, I think it was 25, maybe 30 years ago, the Presbyterian Church, the United Presbyterian Church in the USA, UPC USA, did a study of clergy who had been out in the parish for at least 10 and usually 15 years or more. The Presbyterian Church then found that the pastors followed in their ministry the habits that they developed in their first 5 years of ministry. The habits about sermon preparation, the habits about returning telephone calls, the habits about visiting or not visiting visitors, that kind of thing. The habits that ministers developed in the first 5 years of ministry, the Presbyterian Church found, were the habits that these pastors tracked with for the next 20, 25, 30 years. I have found that to be true in my own experience, and sometimes that's real frustrating. I did not develop very good habits of doing preparatory work early enough with regard to preaching. I'm trying to get to the point where I can have a pretty good handle on my sermon on Thursday, not for Sunday, but for a week from Sunday, because I understand that extra work and that extra time and the extra period of reflection and the chance to pull together some real-life situations for examples really is helping me a great deal. But boy, have I struggled to bring that lead time a little bit farther away from the Sunday I'm going to preach. Surprise number three. I have been surprised how important it is and how challenging it is as well to maintain a personal life as well as a study life in the ministry. We are in a ministry where people pull and take from us on a daily, maybe sometimes even an hourly basis. We are here to rescue that people, we're here to serve that person, we're here to minister to that person. And there's a point where the well starts to run dry. And I didn't understand how important it is for myself and my family to be involved at least in some level of Bible study and prayer, to maintain some kind of quiet time for myself. I need to do that for 10 to 12 minutes on the front part of the day. I understand how difficult it is to do, but folks, we have to be disciplined to the point where we carve out that time for ourselves, because soon the well runs dry. If some of you have come out of the Colorado District, I served there in the Boulder County area for 9 of my last 11 years. I saw three of our very, very, very capable pastors between the ages of 30 and 50 who in two cases were forced to leave the ministry and one case was removed to another district because of family and moral failure. That was within a 5-year period. There's something happening when the pressures of our ministry disallow us to maintain a personal study life, a personal devotional life, and a personal quiet time when we can recharge our batteries. Sabbatical weeks, at which some of the pastors are here, what a great start. Now let me encourage you in that the people in the congregations I have served in every instance have encouraged me also by way of budget line items to do that continuing education, to get away and take that vacation. And the only person who has trouble with that is Stuart Schultz. The only person who's going to make vacation time happen, the only person who's going to make study time happen, the only person who's going to make continuing education happen for you and your ministry is you. I didn't learn that early enough in my ministry. I wish I would have known it 18 years ago. Item number four. I have been surprised how much ministry is people skills. In preparation for coming here this week, I talked with a few of the professional people in my congregation. We have something of a high-octane congregation along that line for as small as we are. 4 physicians, maybe a dozen nurses, accountants, that kind of thing. One of the people I talked with was a young ophthalmologist. He's 8 years out of medical school. And I asked him, Dr. Brueggemann, what has been your impression of coming out of medical school at Indiana University and coming into a practice? What lessons have you learned about things that are different for you from when you came out of medical school to where you are today? What's the big difference in expectation and reality? And he said, Stu, when I came out, I saw every patient as an eye. And he says, today I see every eye as a patient. And he said, that's made all the difference in my private practice. He's an ophthalmologist. He said, I need to sit down with people and ask them where they are in their life, what are the stresses, how you doing, how's the family going? We can do that, and we're in a small enough town. And he said, I have to learn people skills to maintain my ability to be an effective doctor. What an insight. He first, coming out of medical school, saw every patient as an eye, and now he sees every eye as a patient. What an insight. There's a point where we want to see every one of our members as a child of God, and not every child of God simply as a member can make all the difference in the world. There is a phrase that probably is being written a little bit too far, and yet maybe the reason it's written as far as it is because it's true. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. How true. People do not care how much you know until they know how much you care. I don't know why we don't do better, probably, in people skills. Not a congregation I've been in has dealt with conflict very well. It's one of the items of continuing education that I want to do. Conflict resolution and dealing with conflict, it's been a matter that has preceded me in every congregation. It's a matter in so many congregations that I'm familiar with, and we do such an inept job in addressing that. People skills. I need to tell you that the current casus belli, the current state of war in our congregation, is who is going to serve donuts on Sunday morning. We have been going at this for about a year. The reason I bring it up is that the way we settle the donut question in our congregation, who's going to serve it, when they're going to be served, who's going to clean up, who's going to be responsible, the way we solve that question, we hope soon, is going to model for us how we're going to deal with other questions as well. And people have a right to see us settling the small things as well as the large. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Surprise number five. The first five are in some differing levels of importance. The following few are not going to be quite so important, I think, or at least of not the same urgency. I didn't know how important continuing education was going to be for me in my ministry. We have in our congregation a doctor, C.O. Weddle, who's a general surgeon. Talked with him last week about this idea. He says that in his practice, he is required, every 2 years, required to have 75 hours of continuing education. That's fully one full week of continuing education every year. That's what's required. And he said, beyond that, there are the things I want to do to stay current in my field of surgery. So he breaks out time on a weekly basis to read those journals. And he takes out time on a monthly basis to meet with other surgeons and other staff at the local hospital for meetings in which they discuss their cutting-edge skills. Well, no pun intended there. 75 hours every 2 years. That's their way of staying current with their profession. I don't know if we can require it, but maybe we need in the ministry to come real close to requiring something like that. Beyond which, those of us in the ministry will want to do those things that are going to give us that expertise that is so desperately needed. I am finding that I am being met with end-of-life issues today that I did not have 5 years ago. Dr. Kevorkian has only introduced on a national scale what is happening on a daily scale every single day in our hospitals. And I'm being put in a position at least to give a perspective, if not some answers. I'm not prepared for that very well, so that's a point of continuing education for me. We don't deal with conflict very well in congregations, another point of continuing education for myself. I want to say that the Missouri Synod doesn't do the best job or as good a job as it can with multiple staff ministry. Most of us are trained as generalists, and we go into most congregations for the most part equipped as Lone Rangers. And when we come into congregations, when we're put together with multiple staff, it's just a whole different dynamic. One of the continuing education items for me is to try to understand more about how multiple staff ministry works and what are the pitfalls. And Right now, the district presidents, I am told, use the number that may be 1 out of 7 or 1 out of 8 multiple staff ministries, that is, multiple pastoral staff ministries, is doing well. We need to take a look at that. I need to take a look at that because I'm in multiple pastoral staff ministry at the present time. Surprise number 6. I did not know how important a sense of humility and humbleness is in a congregation. There's something that I needed to learn. I didn't know it in my first ministry. I learned it in my second ministry. The ministry was there before you arrived, and it's going to be there after you leave. You can do worse than have as your goal to leave it better than when you came. I didn't understand that, particularly in my first ministry. The ministry was there before you came. Even if you're called to be a mission developer, that ministry was called together in that strange way by gifted people of God and the saints of God, and they called you together. That ministry was there before you came. And it's going to be there after you leave. Is it too much to ask that our pastors don't force change in their first year of ministry? There's going to be plenty of change, but don't force it? What a concept, huh? Going to save you a lot of grief. All of us coming into a new ministry should be able to fly under everybody's radar for at least a year before we start trying to force a lot of change. The rule of thumb that we had some years ago, don't force a lot of change in your first year or two. I might encourage you, don't take yourself too seriously because nobody else is going to. Take your ministry seriously, but not yourself. Surprise number 7, I'm only learning in the last 4, 5, maybe 6 years how important it is for us pastors to be cheerleaders in our congregations. It's probably not the most precise word that I need to use, but it's the word that makes most sense to me. There is a level of maintenance in the ministry, no question about it, and you'll inherit ministries that are doing well and certain programs that are doing well as well. But if you're going to introduce a new ministry or to chart a new direction in ministry, it's not going to happen unless you surround it with a lot of prayer, a lot of energy, and a lot of cheerleading. The people in the congregations I serve, they're in their office 45, 48 hours a week. They have family commitments. They have other commitments in the community. And they're coming to hear some good energy and to see some good energy ascribed to certain parts of ministry. And they look to me, and they will look to you as well, to be the cheerleader who keeps encouraging the saints. I did not know how important that was when I started out 18 years ago. The next surprise, this is an insight from Friedman's book, Generation to Generation. I did not know how important it was to define oneself. I think Friedman's phrase someplace is, define yourself and then be prepared to be sabotaged by those less defined than you are. Every congregation has cross currents. We certainly learn that from the New Testament, don't we? Dr. Christopher Stendel of Harvard once said and made the point that many of us look at the New Testament as kind of a play Bible land world where everybody was doing these pious and decent things, everybody was working together, it was harmony and sweetness and light. You don't have to read the New Testament long before you understand the acrimony and the division and all that sort of thing. That sort of thing, as a result of the brokenness of the world, is with every congregation as well. It is up to us to define ourselves, as that one who has come to bring that good, sweet word of the gospel, where that is appropriate, to bring that word of law as well, and to define ourselves as to what our abilities are and where we can best serve. Particularly when I've come into a new ministry, There have been the folks who, in their own good reasons and with good intentions, want to move the church this way or that way, a third way or a fourth way. And somebody finally has to be the one to say, for the good order of the church and for the wisdom of the kingdom of God, we want to move in this direction. And we need to be bold enough to supply that kind of leadership. Surprise number 9. I did not know how much of my ministry is influenced by what I expect. Let me explain that. People rise, I have found, to the expectation you have of them. If you want to test out that thesis, try that on a 7th and 8th grade confirmation class. You start out, if you do, in confirmation class with the idea that they are but ciphers, without world experience, without tensions in their own families, without much going for them, and you are here to impart a lot of cognitive knowledge to them, and that most, for the most part, they aren't going to learn very much, but let's all get through it. If you start out with that expectation, confirmation ministry isn't going to be very productive and is certainly not going to be very happy. On the other hand, if one starts out with confirmation class as 7th and 8th grade student, with 7th and 8th grade students, that they are here at one of the most formative times of their life. They are eager to hear more about their world around them. That's when they're learning these things. They are starting to be conflicted about their world and themselves, their independence from their parents, but their dependence yet on their parents. And that this is probably one of the richest times to bring to them the truths of God's world, and that they can rise to the task. They'll rise to the task. People pretty much rise to our expectation as pastors of them. Surprise number 10. I don't know, again, if it's just the nature of the individualistic world, but I am astounded how much people today believe that they themselves must determine the nature of their own beliefs. I mentioned to one class my awe when, having been in a congregation a number of years, being personal friends with the elders of our congregation, I learned that twice a year, the wife of one of our elders spent no less than a week at a Zen Buddhist monastery and saw absolutely no disconnect between that and that whole understanding of reality and what she was doing and learning and the path she was walking in the Christian church. Again, maybe it's just the individualistic understanding of our world, but people today, more so than 20 years ago, absolutely insist that they will determine the nature of their own beliefs. That's part of the world we minister to. And we, in our own way, need to be winsome, persuasive, and compelling in the best ways possible, using the best techniques possible to bring them to a point where God's reality is their reality. Surprise number 11. Not everything in your congregation can be fixed. Not everything that can be fixed by you. Not everything that can be fixed by others is going to be fixed very well. Number 12. I didn't know that. I didn't know that 18 years ago. Not everything can be fixed. We've got to live with a lot of ambiguity. Most of us are pretty obsessive, compulsive, anal retentive kind of people. That's, you know, it's just part of our German background. We're rescuers. We like to fix things. Not everything can be fixed. Not everything that can be fixed by you or by me. Item 12. I'm surprised at how much of my ministry is shaped by the size of the congregation I serve. Came from a congregation in Colorado worshiping about 125 with very, very good organist and music director, Paul Robbie's sister, part-time secretary working 15 hours a week. Today, I serve in a ministry with David Faulkner as assistant pastor. We have a director of music and an organist. We're looking for a director of Christian education. We have an administrative assistant, a secretary, another part-time secretary, and a paid custodian. The size of the congregation you serve is going to frame and direct your ministry more than I ever dreamed. That's fun, it's exciting, it's exhilarating, but it's different than I ever expected. Bringing into the ministry the additional component of multiple staff ministry changes the landscape, and I had no clue how dynamic that landscape becomes when you add a larger staff ministry to it. Item number 13, I cue back to my message yesterday, and I want to repeat the statement that I wish somebody would have told me 10 years ago. You cannot be in the ministry and be neat. There is an ingrown frustration in the ministry that so many things are not brought to closure, and one simply learns to live with the ambiguity and the loose ends and all the telephone calls you would like to have made but didn't, and all those visits that you would like to have made but couldn't, and all those times when you stick your foot in your mouth and you wish that people wouldn't notice, but they do. There's just no way to be in the ministry and be real neat about things. There's lots of ambiguity. People are just all over the spectrum, and we need to be aware that that's just a nature of the ministry that we have. 14, I have been amazed, intrigued, and comforted by how much people in the congregation are supportive of me and my ministry. True story. When in Colorado, there was a weekend when I took the youth group on a rafting trip on the Colorado River. Drove 3 hours and then finally found the place, had a long evening of devotions, fun time, slept part of the night outside, got up in the morning, spent about 9 hours rafting down the Colorado River. Great time. Spent most of the night up in the mountains with the youth group. Drove early in the morning back down to the Front Range, preached once, led a Bible class, preached the second time, went to a member's house for dinner, ate too much. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, sat down with a young couple that was about to be married. They're just as excited as they could be. I've come off maybe 5-6 hours of sleep in the last several days, sat down with them, and in about 10 minutes, I fell asleep. And because of the good graces of that young couple, we'd known each other for several years, how incredibly forgiving and supportive they proved to be. Last fall, in a wedding ceremony, large church full of people, 225 people, I had done 105 weddings prior to that. I counted them. Did the whole ceremony. Just a ton of fun. Lots of fun. Got to the point, I said the benediction, they wouldn't move. I said, you can leave. They said, you forgot the rings. Which I had. So we kind of backed up and we did the ring thing. And they were profoundly supportive and forgiving of me because I had known them as well and their parents for years. How supportive they will be. If your heart's in the right place, they'll forgive all those times, most of those times, when you shoot yourself in the foot. Number 15, and I say this with sincerity about my training here at Concordia Seminary, I want to encourage you by something that surprised me. And that was, I was surprised how well-trained I was coming out of Concordia Seminary and being ready for ministry. No question, we all have deficits. We all have those parts of ministry where we need to gain expertise. There are new challenges of ministry that weren't there 5 years ago, and there'll be more and different ones 5 years from now. But I want to encourage you along the lines that when you get out into ministry and you get into your Winkle conferences, or even more so, your meetings of ministerial alliances or ecumenical assemblies or whatever you have is kind of a thing that the pastors gather around in your communities. There's a sense coming out of Concordia Seminary when you can look every other clergy of every other denomination square in the eye. Not in an arrogant or a patronizing kind of way, but with the sense that I am as qualified and as prepared as anybody coming out of any other denominational or independent seminary. I did not have that sense, personally, when I came out of seminary. That was my problem. I owned it. But if I were going back again, I would take much more of a sense. I've got a lot to learn. And I still am not refined in ministry, and I was age 26. But I've come out with a superior education, well-trained in the basics. I've got my tools. I'm capable and equipped for ministry. That was a surprise that I needed to learn 5-8 years into my ministry. I close with a statement that Walter Wangren made. He wrote in the Lutheran about qualities for ministers. He was asked, what does it take to be a minister? Does it take skills as a CEO? No. There's ways to remedy deficits in administrative skills. Do you need to be a superb preacher? It certainly helps, because that's the point of contact with your people more than anything else. Do you need to be a counselor, one who can solve all the problems? No, Wangren said. Said there are two things you need to do. You shall love the Lord your God with your whole heart, with your whole soul, with all your mind. And then you shall love the members of your parish as though they were your very self. Not a bad place to start. You shall love the Lord your God with all your soul, with all your heart, and with all your mind. And you shall love the members of your parish as though they were your very self. Very good words. We need to hear them, and much more to live them. Dean Smith said maybe I should break for some questions. I don't know. I've been all over the landscape here, sowing seeds here and there. Are there questions that people might have? Please.
Spend time preparing sermons, and you have to spend time with your family, and this and that. How do you know what to say yes to and what to say no to and get away with it, so to speak? How do you draw those boundaries and live by them?
Certainly, one, delegate everything you can, not just the things you want to. Okay? I didn't know that. Delegate everything you can, not just the things you want to delegate. We have found it necessary to bring our family devotions to the bedtime hour. Used to have them at dinner time. I've got a son in 9th grade, a son in 7th grade, and a daughter in 5th grade. The dinner hour's taken a beating the last couple of years. Hard to get together. Let people know your frustrations. Let people know in the congregation that you're getting a little bit burnt out, and can they provide some helps themselves about how to delegate and what you can do and what they can do to get you out of the bind a little bit? People will help. Yeah. Please.
I wonder if you could just comment on your experience through the ministry. As America becomes more and more educated and the professional people in your congregation increase, how does that change the congregation's expectations of you as pastor and how you relate to them? Because because you may be a pastor of people who are more educated than you are formally. And I was just wondering how that hinders or helps.
Yeah, that's a fact. In the congregation I serve, I think there are 4 MDs and 2 PhDs, and they're far more educated in their fields. They have attained that level of professionalism in their fields, certainly. A, they are going to be very supportive of you. They are also going to have an absolute awareness of the need for continuing education. I don't know anybody else's experience in the parish ministry, but the desirability for continuing education in the parish, in my experience, is today a non-issue. You don't have to argue for it. You don't have to plead for it. You don't have to plead for it as a line item in your budget. People are minded that for your good health and for the betterment of the ministry, continuing education is going to happen. Beyond that, I think there's a sense that the professionals, too, are coming to the church to hear from you and from the church those good words that equip them. They have a very realistic sense. They don't ask you to be perfect, but they do ask you to be competent. And they understand the difference. I'm not so sure if I'm really zeroing in on your question, but I'm doing it probably the best I can at this point. Dr. Weiss.
Hi. Thank you very much for your presentation. I would just like to resonate with your emphasis on 2 occasions, especially with the use of the languages in the parish towards preaching, especially with how many versions of the scriptures do we have out there. And Grandma Schmidt has the original King James Version, and other people have theirs. So I certainly can resonate with that. And certainly the other emphasis for continuing education, not just for the parish pastor, but certainly for the faculty, I find that's perhaps one area where I need to do some growing as well. So I really, really resonate to that. The other thing is, I'm interested in your comments, some things when I was out in the parish, the issue of pacing. When you want to Velcro some of your people, meaning well, to the side of the sanctuary wall, when they are not listening to you and you get frustrated with, no one cares about me, no one listens to me. How do you, as a parish pastor, deal with those episodic issues in the parish where you just feel kind of all alone and nobody is there except you?
Don't know that I do it terribly well. I find myself going back to the reservoir of my family life. One of the realities in our synod today is, as our society has become very individualistic, I think also our pastors have become quite individualistic. I don't see in our Winkle conferences the collegiality that would be very helpful. I don't see the brothers being willing necessarily to do the kind of encouraging and equipping of other brothers. I mentioned to one of the dorm devotions last night, maybe it is for the new generation of pastors coming through Concordia Seminary as well, to be on the edge of rediscovering the Winkle Conference and making that again into that collegial gathering of the brothers where we can not only discuss those academic papers, that's good too, but also to do that kind of encouraging in the ministry that is so valuable. The Winkles that I've served in haven't had that kind of tenor lately, and so I think we're missing it. District presidents are just completely overwhelmed with their administrative duties. I know they would like to do a better job of being pastor to the pastors, and they're spending so much time in that frustrating business of just administration. I would have to say, I don't know that I can answer that question. I'd have to admit to a deficit there in my own experience right now. Please.
I heard one speaker, I believe it was R.C. Sproul, complain that Pastors Magazines Today are made up of probably 95% of psychological advice and managerial technique. How do you respond to that?
Not only that, but many of the pastors' magazines foster this idea that it is possible for everybody to be a super pastor if you just do this, 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 and this. That's going to create a lot of very frustrated and burned out pastors. There are things we need to learn from the managerial world. A delightful book at the airport I saw at the bookstore, Things I Didn't Learn at Harvard Business School. Really quite good. I read around in that. Probably something we can all read with profit. Unless we find ourselves pretty well immersed in the Word, till we can control that literature of the great Bible truths a little better, find ourselves in prayer. It's real frustrating to have the world defining us as pastors today, as CEOs, when we are to be this dispensers of God's grace. Again, I'm not so sure I completely answer it, except to remind people in the pulpit, to remind people in the meetings that we are here as shepherds. We are not chaplains. We are not CEOs. We are not the perfect preachers, but we are here as shepherds, and to keep that in front of the people. Yeah, please.
Time and family time. Do you find that you can have a close, intimate buddy in the congregation, or do you have to find that kind of emotional support outside?
For my own reasons, and different people answer this differently, we choose to find those folks outside the congregation. It's a little bit safer, and we've always been in communities where you can do that. Colorado, one of our better friends, probably our best friends out there, was a young dentist and his wife who belonged to an ELCA church nearby. We had a lot of common associations with our children. But I know people, pastors, who very successfully have closer friends within the congregation. There are probably at least some yellow flags there, right? How then does one deal with any kind of confrontation if that is necessary? Yeah. Kind of be yourself is a pretty good way to start. And people, again, will be very supportive, my experience. Anyone else? Yeah. I'm in trouble now.
This is a hanging curve. You've talked around it here. I wanted to get back to the point of what you call defining your vision or defining yourself. I want you to define that concept a little bit more. One potential misunderstanding that popped into my head as you were talking about that was the occasional story of a pastor who says, well, I define myself as being good at ABC, and therefore I'm not going to do D, E, and F. I don't make hospital calls. I just don't like it. That's certainly not what you meant. But I think, in a sense, that's our job here. I mean, if people go out from the seminary thinking that there's a checklist from which they can pick those things they enjoy doing, then shame on us. But maybe positively, what do you mean by defining? Are you talking about helping a congregation understand the role of their pastor? I think that's what you're getting at. And how is it out there in today's world? We hear tons of confusion. I'm sure that's a topic that gets bandied around the dormitories a lot, in terms of the whole question defining the office of the ministry, vis-a-vis priesthood of all believers, in terms of congregations and church corporate and all of these sorts of things. How do congregations understand themselves, and how do you help them understand the role of the pastor?
Yeah, fair question. Let me answer that by giving you a little bit of a bird's eye into where I am in my ministry and why that is an issue for me. I am in a town of about 33,000 people. It's a very churched town. town in the center of Columbus, Indiana, is a very large Missouri Synod Church, St. Peter's Lutheran Church, with about 3,000 members. At the northern part of town is a Missouri Synod Church. In the southeast part of town is a Missouri Synod Church. 30 years ago, a group of God's people from St. Peter's decided that they wanted to form a new church on the southwest part of town, in part because they perceived at that time that the pastor at the large church was somewhat heavy-handed. He directed things too much. He was too involved in too many parts of ministry, and they simply didn't like that. So these saints came to the southwest part of Columbus, and they started a church 30 years ago. And a major mindset, a major assumption there, was that for them, the pastor was going to be the chaplain, that he was going to be there to take care of the holy orders, the official acts. But as far as defining the vision of the church, helping to do give some direction to multiple staff ministry, that was all to be left to the lay people. That worked very well for the first 25 years. The church is 30 years old. The frustration has been, in the last years, we've wanted to add multiple staff ministry to do ministry a little better. And we're running into the frustration of trying to do multiple staff ministry led by lay people. You can't do it. You cannot have lay people micromanaging the affairs of a multiple staff ministry on a day-to-day basis. There's a point where the senior pastor has to be willing to step up to the plate and to say, this is not working. And in order for us to have some substance to our ministry and some sense of direction of where we are going, we need to have one common vision. And to get to that point, we can't have four or five people telling all our staff where to go and which direction to go with their ministry. We are struggling with the idea in our congregation now where the senior pastor, myself, I'm trying to work with the congregation, and we're doing it in a winsome and a collegial way. What does it mean to do multiple staff ministry? What have we learned from some false starts over the last 5 years, even preceding myself? And what is it going to mean for me and Dave Faulkner to be in multiple staff ministry, and where's that going to go? And I don't see a direction for that to go except that the senior pastor gradually takes on the leadership of the staff and gradually is the cheerleader for the vision of the church. I'm not saying that's without tensions. It has some built-in tensions, but that's where we are. And I need to be strong enough to define myself to say, I'm comfortable leading a staff of eight. I'm comfortable trying to bring a sense of mission to the congregation. I'm comfortable being the transition pastor and moving the congregation to a next level of membership. And I need to tell people that. Does that help? Define yourself. This is what I think is good for the congregation. You have to be astute enough to know what's good for the congregation and then to go with it. That's my understanding of defining yourself. Associate pastors and assistant pastors, it's something of a challenge there. You're less able to define yourself, particularly if you have a specialized ministry description. Yeah. Other questions? You've been too good a crowd this morning. Thank you for your attention. Thanks for having me here. Yeah.